And the second case for the day is Hill versus Rogers. You may need to give me some help with the names. And Mr. Castiglione?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. I am Paul Castiglione, and I represent defendant appellant Michael Rogers, a former assistant state's attorney in this case. Your Honors, the district court should have granted summary judgment in favor of former ASA Rogers for two reasons. First, when Rogers interviewed plaintiff Harold Hill and took his statement in connection with the rape and murder of Kathy Morgan, he was performing a prosecutorial function. And Mr. Rogers should be absolutely immune from suit on the basis of performing this function. And second, under this Court's 1994 decision in Buckley v. Fitzsimmons, the alleged creation of false evidence, as opposed to the use of that evidence at trial, does not violate the constitutional right to a fair, the due process right to a fair trial. And as a result, the claim against Mr. Rogers should have been dismissed on the grounds of qualified immunity as well. Plaintiff in this case, Your Honors, offer the same limited and cramped version of absolute immunity that the plaintiffs in Buckley v. Fitzsimmons advanced to the U.S. Supreme Court. That is, that prosecutorial immunity should be limited to actions essentially taking place in a courtroom. And that's simply not the law. Buckley itself recognized that the professional evaluation of evidence assembled by the police, by a prosecutor, is a prosecutorial function, and it happens early on in the proceeding.
Even if we accept your view, is that there's still a question as to whether your client, at the time he acted, was acting on the prosecutorial side of the fence or on the investigative side of the fence? Isn't there still a question on the facts of this case as to whether or not the investigation had in fact come to a close and that your client was, in fact, beginning the process of charging the defendant?
Your Honor, no. We would say absolutely not. And I think maybe the shorthand way to look at that is when the police called Mr. Rogers, or called felony review, they were not looking for help to determine who the culprit or who committed this crime.
How do we know that?
Well, we know that because Mr. Hill testified at his deposition that he told Detective Boudreaux that he was asked, who did this crime with you? And which he said, Junior and Pete. So that.
But he also gave some testimony saying that he did not admit that.
That's true, Your Honor. But
so don't we have a dispute of fact on that?
Not in this, in the sense that he, at one point prior to the police calling felony review, clearly Mr. Hill, by his own admission, admitted his own involvement in the crime. So at that point, the police had reason to believe.
That's not what the judge found as an undisputed fact or a disputed fact.
Well, that isn't what the judge found, but our position, Your Honor, is that that this court can certainly hear this appeal. Johnson versus Jones does not preclude this court's jurisdiction because based on the undisputed facts that we know are in the record, Mr. Hill inculpated himself for this crime to the police. The police called felony review, who dispatched Mr.
Yeah,
Rogers.
It also shows that at the time he made the statement, which you characterize as inculpatory, he was getting the daylights beaten out of him.
There's no evidence that Mr. Rogers knew of that, Your Honor. In fact, what evidence there is in the record is that he had no knowledge of that. And I think to hold him, well, to say that Mr. Rogers engaged, I think there's a couple different arguments here. To get around absolute immunity, one of the things plaintiffs have argued is that not only the police, but Rogers engaged in coercion with Hill. And there's no evidence of that. In fact, all the evidence in the record points the other way.
Again, from the plaintiff's point of view, he was willing to say anything to get to see a state's attorney, hoping the state's attorney would treat him a bit better than the police had treated him.
But nonetheless, Your Honor, I think, and in fact, he has brought claims against the police, and those claims are not really a subject of this appeal right here.
Now is that when the state's attorney showed up, he became the confederate of the police and not somebody who was there to see that a rule of law was brought to the situation.
That's certainly plaintiff's position. My point is there's nothing in the record to support that.
In the conspiracy count of the complaint, it's alleged that the conspiracy began even before this, isn't it? That they conspired to frame him and that it continued on after this in the taking of the Williams confession and so forth.
Right. Well, but that's the allegation, but there's nothing to support it. In fact, going beyond...
But you're not here on a sufficiency of the evidence assertion. You're here on an interlocutory appeal of the absolute and qualified immunity.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, Williams actually, I think, illustrates in some degree why the what's done in felony review is a prosecutorial function. Mr. Rogers ultimately did not approve charges against Williams.
I guess I don't have a major problem with the concept that charge review is a prosecutorial function in general. My problem is with the specifics of this case, whether we have undisputed facts that allow only one conclusion, that is that he was operating in a prosecutorial function as opposed to investigative function. That's my problem.
Mr. Rogers, we're only talking about 5 hours he was there, and there's no evidence to show that he spoke with the police, that he in fact interacted with the police in furtherance of some conspiracy. In fact, Hill himself testified that Rogers did not, Hill testified that Rogers did not hit or strike him, that he did not threaten him, that he was not present. Importantly, he was not present when the police...
There's an indication in the deposition at page 376 that Rogers was present in the room when the detective hit him, because there was a question put to Hill. Did the detective touch you in any other way or have any other physical contact with you other than what you've already told me about? Answer, after Michael Rogers came in. That line of questioning wasn't further developed in the deposition, but that was his response. And then Rogers left the room for 15 minutes while the detectives reentered to verbally and physically assault him. And when he reentered, Hill was crying. And Rogers himself wrote the confession. And according to Hill, he says, Rogers walked in. He started questioning me. I was crying. I'm like, you know, my eyes were watering. I was agreeing with everything he said. You know, if he's making mistakes of putting my initials, HH, on it, I was like, yeah, okay, I did it. He was like finishing the statement. And then his claim that certain facts were being fed to him by Rogers, those were facts that the detectives knew.
So
however you weigh it, they're these facts, and certainly you can spend them in your favor. But if we look at them in the light most favorable to Hill, don't we have a factual dispute?
No, I would say no, Your Honor, because still, looking in the light most favorable to Hill, what plaintiffs have alleged at worst is fabrication of a false testimony, not coercion, by Rogers. And I think in that sense, certainly fabrication of evidence, we know from Imbler.
Well, wait a minute. There's an inference that could be drawn, though. Rogers is in the room. Nothing's happening. He walks out, and it's sort of good cop, bad cop. He's the good guy, leaves the room. They thrash on him a little bit. He comes back in. The guy's crying.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
but I think that has to be, Your Honor, I think it has to be weighed with the fact that Hill specifically told Rogers, no, they didn't beat on me. I mean, I think that has to be taken into account as well.
Crying, pulling his eyes out, saying that.
But there could be a lot of reasons.
Inferences go in the favor of the non-movement here.
I understand, Your Honor. But, I mean, I think the crying could be attributed to something else.
Could be private participation in the crime, for example.
I'm sorry?
The problem is there are other inferences. There are favorable inferences to the non-movement here.
I think the most, well, I would submit that the most logical inference is that, or the inference we would propose, is that the most that the plaintiffs have most their evidence shows is fabrication of evidence. And I think the mistake the district court made was conflating fabrication with coercion. At the end of the day, there isn't evidence of coercion against Michael Rogers. And absent that, fabrication of evidence, then we're back in Imbler.
Where about a subordination conspiracy allegation?
Well, there really isn't evidence to support that. He wasn't there. I mean, he was there at the point taking a statement. It's true, and interviewing him and taking a court-reported statement, but there's no evidence. There really is no evidence of him being present or having any direct knowledge of any beating. And in fact, the fact that Hill disavowed being beaten to Rogers specifically, I think that evidence
undercuts the nature of your appeal on the qualified immunity and the absolute immunity, that there's not sufficient evidence. That's not the nature.
Oh, no, I understand that. I think there is no direct evidence of coercion. I guess that's a better way to put it. There's no direct evidence in the record of coercion. There may be evidence, or plaintiffs have maybe submitted, they've certainly argued that there was fabrication, but that's not the same as coercion. Talk for a moment about larger issues, the policy implications of this appeal. It's important. Felony review provides an important part. Felony review is a part of the prosecutorial process, an important part. It's important that cases be screened early on and that a prosecutor be involved early on to attempt to weed out cases where there isn't sufficient evidence and to determine whether there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt to prove the elements of a crime. And if assistants on felony review do not have the same immunity afforded to prosecutors at trial, they would be subject to the same sort of chilling effect. Someone could give a statement and then later disavow it. And then, you know, again, if trial prosecutors had to labor under that scenario, there would be a great almost hydraulic force to just dismiss cases or not bring charges. And I think the same concern animates assistant state attorneys on felony review, in that if someone gives them a statement and later disavows it, the notion of being sued civilly in a collateral civil suit would have a chilling effect on the whole purpose of felony review to begin with, which is to screen cases and make sure that cases go forward on admissible evidence. So we submit, Your Honor, and I think this is consistent with the Supreme Court's decisions not only in Buckley but in Vandy, recent one in Vandy Camp as well, that prosecutors on felony review should be given the same latitude and should have the same freedom to be able to perform their jobs that prosecutorial immunity has historically afforded not only prosecutors but judges as well. After all, prosecutors' immunity is quasi-judicial. Both prosecutors and judges are part of the judicial system and need immunity to be able to perform their functions.
So does this mean prosecutors can basically shut their eyes in terms of the interview process, and if they have some suspicion that somebody's being beaten or that something untoward has happened, that they don't have to speak?
Well, certainly prosecutors have, Your Honor, as you know, obviously have a duty to uphold the law. And without a doubt, there is, as going back as Judge Hand found in the Biddle case, there is a cost of prosecutorial. Prosecutorial immunity does not come without a cost. But giving prosecutors the ability to perform their function is important enough that immunity will be afforded. Certainly, there are other ways to prosecute or to regulate rogue prosecutors. No doubt about it. There's the ARDC. There's the Illinois Rules of Professional Conduct. There's internal discipline within a prosecutor's office. So certainly it's not as though prosecutors certainly do his duty. And if he sees something untoward, should not tolerate it for a minute. But there are checks and balances on rogue prosecutors. It's true. I'd like for a moment, Your Honor, to address two other points and then reserve the balance of my time, if I may. One is the district courts applied essentially a bright-line test, saying that the case had not proceeded to the prosecutorial stage because there had been no signed confession given. I think that's wrong for a couple reasons. First of all, as I've already said, Mr. Hill did inculpate himself with his statement to direct.
But the judge made no findings that he did.
That's right. I'm saying that is in the record. But putting that aside, I think the district court applied the wrong standard. I don't think you actually have to have a signed confession.
Isn't there a bright line in Buckley of probable cause that no one should claim prosecutorial immunity if probable cause is not present?
I think they noted that was true in that case. I'm not sure that rule was adopted. But certainly, I think, if you think about what the prosecutor's there for in the first place, the felony review prosecutor, is essentially to come in and see, is there enough evidence to go forward? So I think it's important to note that there are many cases, many criminal prosecutions go forward where no confession is ever secured at all. So certainly, if a police thinks there's enough to go forward and calls felony review in our county and a prosecutor comes out, that's the determination he or she has to make. Is there enough evidence?
And there are others, too. Maybe the prosecutor wants to make a deal with this guy to get the other two or something like that. So information needs to be known.
That's right.
The problem is the facts in this case.
Well, I think there was a conflating, and not to repeat, but I think there was a conflating of fabrication and coercion. I think at the end of the day, there just wasn't direct evidence of Mr. Rogers engaging in coercion. Briefly, I want to save some time. On qualified immunity, under the Saussure test, the first part is that the question is the plaintiff established a violation of the constitutional right. We rely on this court's 1994 decision in Buckley that the fabrication of evidence itself is not a violation of a constitutional right. And based on that, that you wouldn't even need to get to the second part of the Saussure test, and Mr. Rogers would be entitled to qualified immunity. As we acknowledge in our motion to stay this appeal, there's a case pending in the United States Supreme Court, Pottawatomie County, Iowa versus McGee, where, in which, in fact, oral argument is scheduled for next Wednesday, November 4th, where among the issues is there was an alleged split between the circuits, between this circuit and Buckley and the Eighth Circuit and McGee, and that, I imagine that case may resolve that issue. If
right.
The court has no further questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Well, you're already out of time.
Oh, well, thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Ainsworth.
May it please the court, counsel.
And counsel, we had a lot of questions for you, so I'll give you 1 minute in rebuttal, even though you're out of time. Go ahead.
This case is about how Mike Rogers, the defendant in this case, got three men who didn't know each other to give identical confessions to a horrific crime, including details only known to the killer or somebody who had access to the police reports. The third man, Peter Williams, we know could not have committed the crime because he was incarcerated at the time the murder occurred. And all of the three men said that they did it with Peter Williams. The other two have since been exonerated by DNA evidence, proving that they never, in fact, had anything to do with this crime. However, they spent almost over 14 years incarcerated as a result of the coerced confession obtained by Defendant Rogers. The facts in the case, as presented in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, as found by Judge St. Eve, show that the confession was coerced by Defendant Rogers and that plaintiff has an actionable Fifth Amendment claim that is not precluded by absolute immunity. The only link between the three confessions is Defendant Rogers. There are different detectives involved in each one, and that goes to the conspiracy count that we have. In this case, Buckley, the Supreme Court's decision in Buckley controls. There is no absolute immunity, and there cannot be absolute immunity before probable cause comes in. Buckley does make a bright line rule, and that's the be-all end-all on that point. I'd like to talk a little bit about Johnson and how that affects.
Talk a little bit about Buckley after it came back to this court. That language that your co-counsel or opposing counsel referred to about fabrication.
Fabrication of evidence has been recognized in this case, in this circuit, as being a constitutional right. The Newsom established in 2001 in the Seventh Circuit that fabricating, manipulating a witness's testimony is a actionable constitutional deprivation. In this case, coercing somebody's their own confession is undeniably a violation of a constitutional right. What Buckley 4 really talked about was a distinction between, in that case, it was talking about manipulating a third party's testimony. Or a third party coercing a third party to make inculpatory statements of somebody else. And the act of coercing that third party does not implicate the criminal defendant's constitutional rights unless and until that statement is introduced at the person's criminal trial or criminal proceedings. And that's undisputed. If Rogers, in this case, had fabricated a confession for Harold Hill, forged his signature, put it in a file in his office, and never shown it to anybody else, there would be no constitutional deprivation. As it's when that confession is introduced in a plaintiff's criminal case, that's when the constitutional deprivation occurs. And because we have there's no claim that the prosecutor who introduced the statement in the criminal proceedings, there's no claim that they did anything wrong or that they were culpable for what befell Plaintiff Hill. It's Defendant Rogers in the guise of a investigator. That's what caused the harm. And I also like to make a couple other comments about Buckley 4, and that is that the defendant never raised this argument below. It wasn't an argument that they ever made to Judge St. Eve. They only raised it in this court at the very end of their brief in an undeveloped argument, And really what Buckley 4 was talking about was that there's a distinction between, one, a third party versus the criminal defendant himself being coerced to confess, and two, the difference between the non-immune investigatory act and the immune, absolutely immune, act of introducing that evidence at trial or in the criminal proceedings. And in this case, we have Rogers, who was never, by his admission, never involved in the actual prosecution of this case. His involvement was only in getting Hill to confess to the crimes. And so Buckley 4 does not preclude this case from going forward. I'd also point out that the Supreme Court's decision in Kalina post Buckley 4 in 1997, the Supreme Court stated that if a prosecutor signs an affidavit providing the probable cause for a judicial proceeding, that that act is actionable. And to the extent that the defendant may try to argue at some point, he hasn't yet, that Hill can't recover against Rogers because it was a prosecutor who introduced his confession, and thus that act was absolutely immune. Kalina knocks out that argument from Buckley 4. I would like to talk about Johnson, and our argument is not that this court doesn't have jurisdiction to hear the appeal. This court has jurisdiction to hear the appeal, but only to the extent that it turns on an abstract question of law. Rogers cannot re-argue the facts that were found by Judge St. Eve.
Does this case turn on an abstract question of law?
Well, the abstract question of law is whether Rogers is entitled to absolute immunity. We think it's clear under Buckley, and we're not seeking an extension of Buckley, we're simply asking the court to apply Buckley. And under Buckley, that abstract question of law is...
What you're basically saying is that there's a genuine issue, triable fact, with respect to whether this was Attorney Rogers was acting in his investigative capacity or in his prosecutorial capacity. Am I right?
That's absolutely correct.
Why is that not simply a genuine issue, triable fact? We don't have appellate jurisdiction. That's the end of the case. Goes back to the district court and it's tried.
Yeah, no argument from me on that.
That's different than what you just said.
It is, Judge. I'm conceding for purposes of this appeal that if you look at the facts in the light most favorable to plaintiff, then the court can make a determination, is that as a matter of law, is Rogers absolutely immune for the acts as alleged in the light most favorable to plaintiff? And it's easily answered, no. Because of the material issues of fact, you have to remand because we cannot say as a matter of law there is absolute immunity. And that's the roundabout way of saying exactly what you said. This is not an appeal that this court should be hearing, but here we are. Rogers is asking for inferences in his favor. He's made the same factual distinction arguments that he made in his brief to the district court. Again, on reconsideration, he's now seeking a third bite at the apple. But this is an interlocutory appeal. Apple's the wrong word. In an interlocutory appeal, you get a blueberry. And he's looking for a third bite of a blueberry. And you can't do that. You can't re-argue the facts. There's nothing in the record as to what Rogers was told by any of the detectives before he spoke to Hill. The record is silent on that fact, and that silence is deafening. Because in the inferences in plaintiff's favor, if plaintiff doesn't confess to the detectives, then... The only thing, the inference from calling in felony review is we need somebody to help us get a confession from Harold Hill. And that's exactly what Rogers proceeded to do.
Set aside for the moment whether he confessed to the detectives. Does it matter whether the detectives told Rogers that he had confessed? If it's in Rogers' mind that there's a confession, does that change the dynamics here?
That's not the facts that we have here. Yeah. It could affect the probable cause analysis, except for the fact that when Rogers comes into the room to speak to Harold Hill, Harold Hill tells him, I didn't do it, I'm innocent, I'm not going to confess. Rogers then leaves and comes back and says, you're going to do this story, while Harold Hill is crying, tells him the victim had a blue coat that you and the other men took off her.
If the officers tell the prosecutor that your guy confessed, how does that affect the probable cause analysis?
Well, it's not the facts that we have here, and we cannot accept that. Under Graham v. Conner, you judge probable cause with an objective reasonable or objective subjective standard, what the person knows subjectively, and you objectively analyze that to determine whether it has probable cause. But here,
Doesn't that get Rogers closer to qualified immunity if he's told that this guy has confessed?
Well, it gets Rogers is entitled to make a claim for qualified immunity, but because he's violated a clearly established constitutional right, he cannot avail himself of it. But he is entitled to make a claim for a qualified immunity as a governmental actor. And that is really what Buckley is about. It's saying that absolute immunity, historically speaking, was very limited, and we can only apply it to those things which at common law were people were absolutely immune for back in 1871. And so we view it narrowly because all governmental actors have the defense of qualified immunity. And so the burden is on Rogers to show that absolute immunity should apply. He's the one who has to convince this court that it should apply. The discussion that Rogers had about whether or not Hill was coerced, the question is whether Rogers hindered Hill's free and deliberate choice of whether to confess, whether his confession was involuntary. And as Arizona v. Fulmonte says, coercion can be mental as well as physical. And when you have an 18-year-old person who's been in police custody for 26 hours, which Rogers knows because he's reviewed all the police reports, and is crying in the room and saying he's innocent, he doesn't want to confess, and Rogers then tells him, you're going to do this story, gives him specific facts known only to the investigators, that there was the victim was wearing a blue coat, that a bottle of wine was found at the scene, that a brown shoe was found at the scene, that, and then gives the framework of a fabricated confession, telling him, you met the victim with the others at 2 a.m. at a party.
Is fabrication enough for you to avoid absolute or qualified immunity here?
Yes. And the reason that is because it's the totality of the circumstances. Fabricating the confession, together with the fact that Harold Hill did not commit this crime. Why does somebody who is innocent of a crime confess? There are many implications, but we get all reasonable inferences in our favor. And one reasonable inference is that when somebody is telling you, do the story, these are the facts that you have to say, that means that it was not a voluntary confession.
And so your position is it's fabrication coupled with all the circumstances.
Yes.
Really equal coercion.
Because that's what you always have to look at when you're determining whether a confession is voluntary. It's the totality of the circumstances. And under these facts, it's the fabrication under the circumstances of a guy been there 26 hours, 18 years old, innocent of the crimes, telling Rogers that he's innocent, yet Rogers then pressing him to include details of that crime. Rogers' counsel spoke about policy implications. These exact same arguments about the policy implications were raised by Justice Kennedy in the dissent in Buckley, saying that the Buckley decision was somehow going to transform the defense of absolute immunity into a pleading requirement. That hasn't happened. We've had 14 years, 15 years, since the Buckley Supreme Court issued its decision in Buckley. And the dearth of case law in the Seventh Circuit on absolute immunity shows that it was not a open door to all this kind of litigation. In fact, the best way to ensure that these kind of abuses do not occur is the light of public inquiry. As Justice Brandeis said, publicity is justly commended as a remedy for social diseases. Sunlight is to be the best of natural disinfectants, electric light the most efficient policeman. And those words ring just as true today under these circumstances. A public trial is the best way to shed light on what really happened back in 1992. Now, counsel in his brief mentioned the Imbler case, that this is really just suborning perjury. It's talking about apples and oranges. This is not a case of suborning perjury at trial. That's what Imbler is talking about. Things that are intimately associated with the judicial phase of the process, like putting on witnesses at a trial, that is entitled to absolute immunity because that's what the common law immunity extended to. When you're acting as an investigator and you're getting somebody to confess involuntarily, you are acting akin to a police officer. And it would be unjust to hold Detectives Boudreaux and Halloran only qualified immune for the same acts as Rogers would be given absolute immunity just because Rogers happens to have a law degree. That's what Buckley says this court cannot do. Again, there's no... The different facts, Rogers might have a different argument, but there's the facts found by Judge St. Eve which cannot be contradicted in this interlocutory appeal. This court must remand the case to be heard for trial because Rogers cannot establish as a matter of law that he's entitled to absolute immunity. And Harold Hill is entitled to his day in court for the injustices that he alleges Defendant Rogers perpetrated upon him. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Ainsworth. Mr. Castiglione? 1 minute.
Your Honor, Detectives Halloran and Boudreaux had determined in their mind that there was probable cause, and that's why they called the police. And that's consistent with Buckley that plaintiffs are relying on here. There is a different function that the police form and a prosecutor forms. If a police determine there's probable cause, that's why the felony review assistant is called and comes out, to make a professional determination. Those are different functions. And I will go back to what I initially said. Plaintiffs, at the very end of the presentation, offered the same view of absolute immunity that was specifically rejected in Buckley. It's not simply limited to the courtroom. I'd like to make a couple other brief points. In response to your Judge Tender, your question.
I appreciate the promotion. Hope it comes with pay, too.
To your question about Buckley 4, plaintiffs did not cite Newsom in their brief, and in fact, I recall Newsom dealt with lineups. I don't recall it in any respect overruling or modifying but the holding of Buckley 4, but the fabrication of evidence is not does not constitute a violation of the Due Process Clause. And in fact, the very fact that the Supreme Court is considering whether Buckley 4 or McGee were to resolve that split, I think would show that Buckley 4 is still the law of the circuit.
All right. Thank you, counsel. All right. Thank you, both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.